Thank you, Your Honor. Obviously, this discussion we're about to have involves many of the same issues involved in Mr. Krupp's case. I think Mr. Cooper's case presents a starker case for the elimination of post-conviction waivers that are not truly voluntary and intelligent. Mr. Cooper was that defendant who pled guilty and who, as a condition of his guilty plea, was required to waive post-conviction relief. But the record here does not reflect what part of that plea agreement was attributable to his waiver of a trial, and what part was attributable to the waiver of his post-conviction remedies. Just as in the Burgess case, recently decided by this court, the record does not reflect with absolute clarity whether the waiver here was voluntary and intelligent. One of the things that we have discussed in the preceding case was whether or not, the movement's statements, the defendant's statements that he's giving up post-conviction relief somehow settled the issue in the absence of any further questioning. And I don't necessarily know that they do in this case. Mr. Cooper agreed that he was giving up post-conviction relief, but the record is silent as to whether he was a recipient of advice from counsel, or whether he just how he arrived at that decision. One of the things that the state has argued in connection, and I think the court has mentioned to me as well, is that if we take away this ability to waive post-conviction relief, aren't we taking away an important bargaining chip? I think that such waivers are valuable only when they can be said to be absolutely voluntary and intelligent. And as I said before, I believe that if the defendant decides to waive post-conviction relief against the advice of counsel, knowing that maybe counsel said, I might have messed this up or I might have failed to do this investigation, I suppose in that instance it could be a voluntary waiver. We don't know from certainty on the record below whether the waiver here was voluntary and intelligent.
Your opponent in the last case argued that it was the movement's obligation to plead facts that would demonstrate that it wasn't voluntary. And so the failure, the fact that we don't know is a failure to plead on behalf of your client rather than a problem with the proceeding.
Well, I would disagree. I think the waiver was apparent from the record. The motion court appointed post-conviction counsel. I should say the fact of a waiver was apparent from the record. The motion court appointed post-conviction counsel not to evaluate the waiver, not to show cause why this waiver should not be enforced, but to represent the movement post-conviction. I don't know that post-conviction counsel can ethically sort of inject an issue into the proceedings that might be entirely harmful to his client's case. I think the fact of the waiver was there. It was no
secret. I'm afraid I don't understand what you mean there. I mean, obviously, if there's appointed counsel in a PCR proceeding, the filing of an amended motion is common. Are you
yes.
suggesting that in a scenario like this, an appointed counsel wouldn't feel comfortable amending the motion to claim that the waiver of the PCR rights was not knowing and voluntary?
Counsel could do so, but I don't know that, that counsel would necessarily, want to, absent some direction from the court. I mean, if the motion court had said, Mr. Thompson, I want you to show cause why I should not grant this this motion, or if the state had filed some sort of responsive pleading suggesting that this waiver should be enforced, certainly counsel can advocate as to why it shouldn't be enforced.
But in other scenarios where a defendant claims a waiver of some right was not voluntary, it is the defendant's obligation to raise that issue. Is that correct?
I mean, typically, I mean, I think typically, but if the court is, as it did here, evidenced a desire to proceed with the post-conviction matter, I mean, I don't know that, you know, that ethically, if I were post-conviction, as post-conviction counsel, I would feel entirely comfortable promoting this affirmative defense, saying, look, there's a real problem with this case, Judge. I think my obligation is to be a vigorous advocate for my client.
You're saying if we put the burden on defense counsel to raise this issue, and if they don't, then we allow the state to raise it on appeal or the court on appeal to address it for the first time, as occurred here, you in effect are just inviting the state to never raise it below, or putting counsel in this conflict situation.
I think you're putting counsel in this conflict situation. If obviously counsel has a duty of candor to the court, but if the waiver's there and the court expresses a desire to litigate the post-conviction motion, I don't know.
Are you saying that state shouldn't be able to raise it for the first time on appeal? It's something that has to get raised below or what?
Yes, I believe so. Just like this dispute about the timeliness of Form 40 filings and whether those affect the jurisdictional competence of the court.
Well, as I understand the facts in this case, I mean, the amended motion alleged that that counsel coerced this defendant into pleading guilty, but what the motion court did here, which I think was the same court accepted the plea, made a finding that that allegation was refuted by the record. So how does that make this waiver different than any other type of waiver?
I'm not sure I understand the court.
Okay. Well, as I understand the amended motion in this case, as I understand it, alleged that this defense lawyer coerced by threats or whatever this person into pleading guilty, which included the waiver of the post-conviction.
Correct.
But as I read the motion court's findings, the motion court considered that allegation that the defendant was coerced and said that based upon the transcript that the movement stated under oath he was pleading guilty of the charges voluntary of his own free will and that no one had forced him into entering the guilty plea. And therefore, that there was no ineffective assistance of counsel. Well, what makes this waiver any different than, say, for example, the waiver of the right to a jury trial? If the motion court can look at what the transcript said at the guilty plea and thinks those allegations are refuted by the record. In other words, this lawyer didn't coerce him to waive his right to trial. He didn't coerce him to waive his right to appeal. He didn't coerce him to waive his right to post-conviction. What makes it any different?
Well, I mean, looking at that? Not to sound like a broken record, but I think advice by counsel as to whether or not to waive jury sentencing or other rights presupposes the assistance of counsel. When we're talking about waivers of post-conviction relief, it's difficult to say whether or not that decision was made with the assistance of counsel. If counsel did assist in the making of that decision and did offer advice about whether or not to take this package deal, then that lawyer was being unethical. If there was no consultation with his attorney, then it was an uncounseled waiver. So I think
there was no litany here as to whether or not counsel had advised him to waive PCR rights, was there?
I don't believe so, Judge.
There's nothing in the record. So just the standard question, simply just don't go to that.
I don't think so. I mean, there were no questions in either of these cases about whether or not counsel had advised to make this waiver of post-conviction rights or whether there had been any discussion of it or whether counsel had stepped back.
Did the trial court here make any specific finding as to whether counsel had advised or given any information to defendant about the PCR waiver issue?
I don't believe the
findings below were more generally on the claim and claimed ineffectiveness?
This was a judge. The original judge had retired. It was a later judge that was examining this record, not the one who took the guilty plea originally.
I have a question. When just merely entering a guilty plea, doesn't the defendant waive any claims that would have for PCR? I mean, you're limited PCR relief on a guilty plea, and so aren't you giving up all of those claims that you were saying, well, there might be a failure to investigate, and so all you have is whether or not the guilty plea was voluntary on a PCR claim. So doesn't that somehow play into your ability to waive that PCR claim?
I would agree that the law suggests that we're considering the effectiveness of counsel in regards to a guilty plea. It only matters as to the extent that it affects the voluntariness and intelligence of that guilty plea. I guess I would say that if there is some blind spot, or worse yet, some knowing withholding of information from the defendant that rendered that guilty plea involuntary, the expedient of waiving post-conviction remedies doesn't really solve anything.
And the Eighth Circuit has said failure to investigate can be raised as a PCR, because then it can't be knowing, because you don't know what you're waiving.
Well, that's just it. I mean, if the court was later to find, you know, prima facie belief that there was, you know, rank ineffectiveness, there was exculpatory evidence that could have been brought to bear, then.
But certainly by pleading, you narrow the issues greatly that you could raise.
Yes.
What kind of proof would you have to make to say the waiver was involuntary? I mean, how do you have an involuntary waiver?
Well, I think it would be this similar proof that is required to show that the plea was involuntary. So if there was, maybe a misapprehension about parole eligibility, for instance, if the defendant thought he was only going to serve 40%, but really because counsel had so advised, but really the crime required an 85% sentence. I mean, if there
Does
was...
Does that go to the intelligent aspect versus the involuntary aspect?
Yes, I think that would go to the intelligent.
So what's an indicia of involuntariness?
I think for any decision to be voluntary, it has to be intelligent, and it has to be with the assistance of counsel. So although I said I could offer you an example, I'm not sure if I can really offer an example of an involuntary.
Thank you.
Unless he's laboring under some, you know, misapprehension.
That's okay. I just have a question. Any more questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I expect to spend the bulk of my time, I think, speaking about the issue this court's probably most concerned about in this particular case, and that's that this issue was not addressed in the motion court below. But before I get there, I did want to address the argument that Mr. Thompson made about that requiring the movement to plead and prove that his waiver was involuntary somehow puts counsel in an ethical quandary. In this case, Mr. Thompson is not a criminal defense attorney.
How do you prove involuntary?
I'm sorry?
How do you prove involuntary?
How would he prove that it's involuntary?
Yes.
I think he would have to prove, certainly if it was coerced in some way, if it was literally coerced.
What kind of coercion?
I think he could be, I'm sorry?
Go ahead. Continue.
He could be physically coerced into waiving his right to file a 2435. Or I think that he could be, could have waived it under fraud or duress or something like that. Similar to, I think, what the way a contract might be void because one of the parties entered into it because they were, they entered into it under fraud or duress or mistake.
Well, I think the conflict he's saying that might arise for a defense attorney is if neither the state nor the court raises the issue of waiver, then wouldn't it be detrimental to his client for him to raise it in the first instance?
And what's important to remember, though, is that in this case, Mr. Thompson doesn't represent or in any similar case, he wouldn't represent a criminal defendant. He represents a movement. He represents someone who is bringing a cause of action before the court, and he is required to plead and prove that cause of action. That argument would be like saying that someone with a tort, It would be improper to require someone with a tort claim to plead and prove all the elements of the tort because his lawyer might find out.
What Judge Stiff is saying is if the movement files a claim and alleges ineffective assistance of counsel, but they have waived PCR relief and no one challenges them going forward with it, why would they want to raise the issue that they waived it but didn't do it effectively if they are being allowed to proceed on it?
And with your analogy to civil law, waiver is an affirmative defense. You don't actually have to plead, I didn't waive my right to bring this tort suit. You wait for the other side to raise it, and then you respond.
Well, and I suppose how this is different from those suits is that that waiver is not exactly an affirmative defense in this situation, because for several reasons. The court has the authority to deny relief for any reason that's clear from the record. It doesn't have to be raised by either party. Second of all, the prosecuting attorney is not required to file a responsive pleading, much like as opposed to the way it is required in a civil case. And so in that way, it is different. It's not an affirmative defense.
So you withdraw your analogy to the civil context? Because you're saying this is a civil case and we should treat it like that. So didn't that raise this issue, that waiver is an affirmative defense?
I suppose the argument is better. It may be better put forward in the timing cases.
In the what cases?
In the timing cases. It would
but
be more analogous to those. In that, clearly, in those situations, the movement does have the burden to prove that their motion was timely filed. This court has consistently held, though, that a motion court's findings and conclusions should be affirmed if they can be affirmed, even if they reach the result for the wrong reason, if they can be affirmed for any reason that's clear on the record. And in this case, the movement's waiver was clear on the record.
But the trial court did not do that. The trial court reached the merits.
Exactly.
So why could you raise this? You're saying on appeal, this case in the Court of Appeals was briefed on the merits, and the Court of Appeals on its own addressed the waiver issue and found they'd waived it. And now you're complaining that they're raising the waiver issue in this court, saying they shouldn't have done it. But in what other context? There's nothing for them to appeal otherwise. They couldn't appeal the waiver issue because they won on that. Nothing had been done on that. I'm not clear how you're saying they should have raised it earlier.
Well, I suppose. I mean, I think they should have raised it in the motion court. That's where it should have been raised. Because they're the only party here that's required to put issues before the motion court. That's how the issues get before a motion court and how we have findings and conclusions.
But the motion court didn't find against them on that. So why should you get to raise it for the first time up here in this court?
Well, simply because it's clear from the record that it was waived and that this court can affirm for any reason that is clear from the record. There was an actual written waiver of 2435 that specifically told him that he had the right, that he would be waiving the right to complain about the effective assistance of counsel.
Wouldn't we need to remand for determination of the voluntariness of that waiver?
That's possible, although at this point, even strictly speaking, the voluntariness of that waiver has not been raised at all. His argument before this court is that waiver is per se invalid because it's a violation of the ethical rules. As far as him personally being coerced or intimidated in some way personally into waiving this, those are allegations have never arisen. So I don't know that there's any need to
remand it. So should the court have some kind of evidence before it that the defendant says on the record this waiver has been given voluntarily and intelligently?
I certainly think if a waiver is going to be part of the plea agreement, that it should certainly be part of the record, that the court should address it as much as possible on the record. I mean, either in the transcript or, you know, if the defendant files pleadings that indicates that he understands all the rights and he wants to waive them. I think certainly in this case, not exactly every one of the rights was gone over in the transcript. All of them were, with the exception of his right to challenge the effective assistance of counsel. But otherwise, he affirmed all the other rights and affirmed that he'd gone over them with counsel.
Yeah. Didn't this court remand Burgess for purposes of a hearing, and because there weren't findings of fact and conclusions of law made on the issue of whether or not the waiver was intelligently and voluntarily given? So why wouldn't that particular remedy be appropriate in this situation? In other words, if if you always have the right to inquire as to whether or not a guilty plea was knowingly and voluntarily given, no matter what was given up, why would this be any different?
Well, two reasons. I think this court's decision in Burgess was clearly based on the rule. The rule requires the court issue findings of fact and conclusions of the law. And I don't recall the court citing any other.
But why does the rule require that? Because we want trial courts who see live witnesses to make those decisions for us. Isn't that the logical reason why that's required? And if they're going to base it strictly on the record, we still require findings because generally that was the same court that took the plea and is familiar with the record and the parties and the testimony in the case.
I suppose. But the second reason that it's unnecessary in this case is just it's also the court's finding on the merits are also correct, and that would be why a remand would be unnecessary. This court could, bypass the waiver issue, I suppose, in this case.
And if we did that, you're suggesting that we would bypass the waiver issue and just rule on the merits because the state failed to raise it. Because how else would we get there?
Well, I guess the issue would need to be addressed. Well, I suppose the issue doesn't have to be addressed. I mean, the court could just affirm for that and just not address the waiver issue at all, I suppose. But I guess implicit in that finding would be a failure to enforce the waiver because of a lack of a finding of fact.
I ask your opponent the issue of whether he's asking us to find that waiver of PCRs should not be honored or valid. And I asked him if that was taking away some right of a defendant to a plea bargain. But in truth, isn't this just a trend that's come up in the last couple of years and someone came up with the idea and now it's being followed? And haven't plea bargains gone on for years and years and years with nobody ever waiving PCR? And that it's such a can of worms as to how is it going to be raised? Do you have to have another attorney? Can they challenge it in PCR because it might not have been voluntary? For the good of the system, should waiver of PCRs, that's now kind of a new thing, should that be permitted?
I don't know that I can speak to the waiver of them in Missouri. Certainly some of the federal cases that we cited are quite a bit older, at least a decade. I think this has been going on in the federal system for quite a while, that waiver of post-conviction rights, or at least certain post-conviction rights, have been a part of plea agreements in federal courts for quite some time. I think the way to keep it simple is just, simply if the waiver is found to be valid, I mean, if the waiver is found to be voluntary on the record, then it should be upheld unless the defendant pleads and proves that waiver was somehow involuntary. And I think that's the way to keep it simple.
But even with the waiver, there's a requirement of appointment of PCR counsel and to file the amended waiver, the amended motion challenging the waiver. It certainly adds a lot of issues and a potential for a lot of hearings on issues such as actual conflict or potential conflict that haven't been a part, and people seem, and prosecutors and defense attorneys seem to have entered plea bargains for years without this mechanism.
Well, and I suppose that it might very well be that prosecutors and defense attorneys will see that and may decide that the waiver is more trouble than it's worth. That very well may be the case. But as a matter of either constitutional principle or as a matter of the rules, I think the argument that this is somehow invalid or somehow something improper, unconstitutional about this just fails. There's mm-hmm. It just isn't there.
According to the rules, advisory opinion 126, any party who believes they're aggrieved by that could seek review, correct? So a defense lawyer or a prosecutor could seek review of opinion 126 if they wanted to. Are you aware of whether or not any prosecutor or defense lawyer has ever sought review of that opinion?
I'm not aware of it, and I'm not sure if the rules require someone to actually breach the rules before they can challenge it, or if they can just challenge it, you know, in anticipation of wanting to, you know, breach that advisory opinion. But as far as I know, I'm not aware of anyone having brought it up. I did want to address one issue that did come up earlier, as far as an excessive sentence. This court held, as I recall, I believe the case was State X Rel Osowski, and I'm sorry, this was not in my brief, this is off the top of my head, but it's from a issue that was brought up earlier. In State X Rel Osowski versus Perkett, which was a habeas case, that treated an excessive sentence very much like a jurisdictional issue, and this was before Wasiskala versus Webb, but
Meriwether also, I think, is a case that did that.
And Meriwether as well. And so an argument could be, you know, I guess those issues might need to be, and I don't recall whether Meriwether came after Webb. I think that was still before Webb as well.
In 2 years ago, we held that a sentence that was longer, a written sentence that was longer than the oral pronouncement of sentence is akin to sentencing beyond the amount permitted by statute and can be raised in a habeas.
I believe that was Zena.
Is that right? Zena, correct.
And the, I guess it, those cases probably relied sort of back on Osowski, and that, and there, that, as I recall, the court treated it as sort of a jurisdictional issue.
And again, Zena was after Webb and still said we still have that.
Right. It's a sort of, it does go the authority of the court, and
right.
To the extent, and so it's recognized as one of the jurisdictional exceptions in habeas is, as things that can be raised in habeas, regardless of whether they were raised before or not raised before.
But other decisions after Zena have indicated that's a very limited exception, and that other issues in post-conviction that could be raised by post-conviction are waived if not raised.
I would suspect that's probably true. Other than issues that don't go to the actual authority or the jurisdiction of the court, unless cause and prejudice or manifest injustice, which would require a showing of actual innocence, would have to be proved. Otherwise, I think, unless the court has any other questions, I think all the issues have been pretty adequately covered. We would just ask that the court dismiss the appeal. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm asking the court to rule on the merits. I did want to say this about the notion that it's somehow okay to allow the waiver of post-conviction rights because there's refuge in state habeas proceedings. I think this really, again, shows that this notion of waiving post-conviction relief creates more problems than it solves. It shifts post-conviction remedies that could be dealt with by the circuit court to a remote jurisdiction where the movement, though he may have a perfectly valid claim, is not guaranteed the assistance of counsel. I'm asking the court to to rule on the merits of this case and not enforce the waiver.